my view of the Bible is that you can't take it as some kind of authority for what, you know, for like modern ethical issues, because the Bible has all sorts of ethical issues depending on what part of it you're reading. And so everybody, whether they admit this or not, everybody who wants to appeal to the Bible for something is picking and choosing what they want to appeal to.
An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hey, everyone. This is the Life After God podcast. Welcome back. My name is Ryan Bell, and I'm your host. This is episode 30, and do we ever have a jam-packed episode for you today? Coming up in just a few minutes, my conversation with renowned biblical scholar at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Bart Ehrman, about his new book called Jesus Before the Gospels. We'll get to that in just a moment. I also spoke briefly to Greta Vosper and Helen Stringer from the Oasis Network about a new collaboration that's in the works. I'll bring you that in just a moment. But before we get into all of that, it's important that we pause for just a moment and reflect on the fact that we have again experienced the scourge of religious fundamentalism in the form of terrorist attacks. First, this past Saturday in Istanbul in Turkey, where several people were killed. And then just late last night on the West Coast, morning in Belgium, in the city of Brussels, one of the airports experienced two explosions. And then again, a third explosion in the Malbik metro station, very near to the European Union headquarters. Just last May, just under a year ago, I was in that airport with Becca, and we got off at that metro station to look around that part of Brussels. And so having just been there, that terrorist attack really strikes close to home for me. We have friends that live and work in Brussels and other friends that live and work in Antwerp, just 30 minutes away. And so our hearts go out to all of those that are suffering this tragedy in both Istanbul and in Brussels today. And, you know, it's not like any ordinary tragedy that, you know, couldn't be avoided, you know, an accident of some kind. This is an intentional attack on people's normal everyday life. These are not enemy combatants that have been killed, but innocent citizens of Belgium and Turkey that were going about their daily activities, including tourists and people that were just shopping in the marketplace in Istanbul and people that were traveling on the metro in Brussels. And it's just another example of the extremism that we're witnessing in our world and why we need to continue to speak intelligently about religion and about faith commitments and about evidence and about humanism. And, you know, this podcast is not primarily about politics and about, you know, Muslim relations around the world. But I couldn't let this opportunity go by to just say how important the work each of us is doing in raising, the awareness about reason and science and rationality and tolerance and humanism, at this crucial moment, because it seems to me that our world is polarizing in two extreme ways. On the one hand, many parts of the world are becoming more secular, and we celebrate the pluralism and secularization that we see in our democracies and in burgeoning democracies around the world. On the other hand, it seems in a reactionary way, other societies are retrenching and using violent means, increasingly violent means, to assert their authority. I have to believe that they will ultimately fail in their efforts, but in the meanwhile, thousands and thousands of people are terrorized and injured, and some are killed in the process. And we all need to do everything we can to raise awareness about the dangers of certain kinds of religion, and some would say religion altogether, and do our best to be witnesses for peace and justice and harmony in our world. And I think the episode that you're about to hear, both the conversation with Bart Ehrman, as well as my conversation with Helen Stringer and Greta Vosper, will illustrate the importance of relativizing the Bible, as I talked to Bart about his new book, and the way that the Bible is weaponized when we take it literally and when we impose a kind of divine authorship upon it. And then again in my conversations with the Oasis community about the efforts that are going into creating vibrant secular community. All of these things are contributing to a more peaceful society, and it couldn't come at a more important time. This morning, March 22, I read some interesting news that I wanted to share with you, something pretty exciting, I think. The Oasis Network, founded by Mike Aus of Houston Oasis and Helen Stringer of Kansas City Oasis, announced that the West Hill congregation in the Toronto area, led by our good friend Greta Vosper, was joining the Oasis family. Oasis is a growing network of secular communities around the country and now in Canada as well. The first Oasis community was founded by Mike Aus in Houston, Texas in 2012, and then Helen Stringer started the Kansas City Oasis community in early 2014. Helen and Greta spoke to me via Skype earlier today to talk about the mission of Oasis and the significance of the West Hill congregation joining the network. Helen has a degree in pastoral studies, after which she discovered she could no longer believe in religious ideologies, so she redirected her career to professional counseling. She is also the founder and executive director of Kansas City Oasis and president of the Oasis Network. Greta, as listeners to this podcast will know, is the pastor of West Hill United Church in the Toronto area of Ontario, Canada, and part of the Life After God leadership team. I began by asking Helen how this new relationship with West Hill and Greta came about.
We were approached by Greta when her congregation, I think, was considering all their options. And as we spoke and shared what our vision is with the Oasis Network and with Oasis communities and where they want to go, it just seemed like a really perfect fit. And we all see the greater benefit of being a part of a larger network of secular communities.
In talking with Greta, she agreed that the marriage of West Hill United Church and the Oasis Network is ideal. Their goals and methods, she told me, line up perfectly.
We meet on a weekly basis, and it's important. A weekly basis, if you want to develop what I call are the off-label benefits of religion, and that's, well, an increased sense of well-being, flipping over even into the concept of flourishing and our ability to flourish, you need to get together with your community that supports you, that recognizes you, that with which you feel comfortable and affirmed. You need to do that at least once a week and maybe even more than that. So we have an experience here in Canada. West Hill launched a satellite community on the other side of the major metropolis that we're in. We're on the far east side, and we launched one on the far west side, but we did it as a monthly gathering. And it has not cohered in the way that we had hoped it would, because people only get together once a month. So we're now launching, or we're pulling together a leadership team to launch an Oasis community in downtown Toronto. And that community, one of the criteria is going to be that it will need to meet once a week in order to establish the kind of community that we want to see.
Helen shared with me that the goal of the Oasis community is to meet the growing need for excellent secular community, and the network of Oasis just enhances everyone's ability to do that by sharing resources and best practices, as well as supporting and encouraging leaders across the country.
The greater vision for Oasis overall is just to provide great secular community. You know, for so long in our culture, religion has held the monopoly on the ability to connect people, multi-generational ages, and in such a way that you meet a human need that in other groups and forms, you just can't achieve quite the same way. So what we're doing is providing a similar opportunity, but removing all the stuff that we either no longer identify with or we can no longer agree with. So it's been a really incredible journey as we, like, I mean, Houston and Kansas City, we're both still, in the grand scheme of things, fairly new communities, but the response that we've received in Kansas City and with Houston, like I said, has been overwhelmingly positive. And so we decided that it was time to create the affiliation out of just need, and people were asking so much. You know, there was a Time magazine article that featured Houston Oasis back in, I think, 2014 fall. And after that, the inquiries just started flooding in. People wanted to know, how are you doing this? What are you doing? You know, and then recognizing that greater support at large. So having a network of communities that have similar goals and values, that we all strengthen each other, that as we kind of get this going, we can learn so much from each other. And then you just have that greater network of support. It just makes total sense.
And Houston is the first one, right?
Yes. They started in fall of 2012.
Okay. So it's really only 4 years old, less than 4 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And in Kansas City, we launched April of 2014.
So yeah. 2 years just coming up on.
We have our 2 year anniversary coming up as well. So
and the Oasis Network is newer yet, right? It's something you guys dreamed of.
I don't have an official date on that. I was probably around the same time. Officially, I think January of last year is when we were able to start forming all the legal, you know, the really exciting stuff, all the legal kind of formations. We wanted to spend the year really building the foundation because we had a feeling that the response would be quick and there would be a lot of desire to do the same thing. Even though what we do is weekly, it's not, you know, a monthly meetup. So what we're offering is a frequent opportunity for people to connect in multiple different ways. And that can be a little daunting. And that's also why to have a network and a working model that has, you know, some backing to it is really helpful. And I know it was helpful for us in Kansas City just to know that we had another sounding board and also to kind of hear their experience. And then we kind of, you know, added our expertise into it. And between the two of Kansas City and Houston, I think the reason why we both have done so well is because we've had each other. And so we hope to be able to offer the same kind of support to everyone else that is coming on board now.
Here again is Greta Vosper.
The two watchwords are autonomy and collaboration. Like each group gets to develop themselves in the manner that they choose to, and we share resources so that the stuff that we've been working on for the last 10 years at West Hill, we'll share that with people there. And, you know, I want a list of all the music that plays at Kansas City Oasis. I want those songs, right? So we'll be able to get that stuff. And the things that they have learned in creating new communities, they will pass on. And the things that we have learned transitioning a community and leading in this kind of a community for many years will pass on. So it's a great relationship.
It might appear that this new relationship with Oasis foreshadows a split with the United Church of Canada, but Greta told me that that's not the case. The congregation continues to be an active part of the United Church, and they are duly affiliated now with the United Church and Oasis.
That's the really great part of this. When we spoke with Houston Oasis and with the Oasis Network, Helen, another representative from Houston, and Mike, one of our questions was, how do you feel about the fact that we're connected to a major denomination and we aren't leaving that denomination? But we would like to affiliate with you. And they were like totally open to that, which I think is great. So I still continue with the challenges that I have with the United Church reviewing my effectiveness, but my congregation's relationship with the United Church continues to be strong. We continue to do our work within the United Church, but we're also now saying, as we have really for the last 10 or 15 years, this work needs to be made accessible to people who have no religious beliefs. And so we're now affiliated with an organization that is committed to creating that kind of safe space. And we're taking the leadership in doing that here in Toronto. And even in sending out the invitations that we have to create a leadership team, we've had people from other communities across the country, and even someone from the UK saying, you know, we really want that to happen here, so keep us posted.
Helen echoed the same sentiments, saying that one of the strengths of the OASIS model is its flexibility.
The response has been overwhelmingly positive, and we are meeting those needs. This is the way of the future, and we are completely flexible. And that's kind of, you know, bringing on an existing church congregation probably for some is slightly confusing, but it shouldn't be confusing at all when we completely align with the values of West Hill and what Greta has been doing out there. We have so much in common, and we think we'll have a really great collaboration together, which is the whole point of the network itself.
It's an exciting development, to say the least, as we watch the secular community take shape in new ways and grow networks that support new secular communities forming all across the country. Just recently, Life After God invited John DeLynn to be a part of the leadership team here. And John has been instrumental in starting two new OASIS communities in Utah. One of those communities was already meeting sort of independently and decided, sort of like Greta's community, to affiliate with OASIS. And there's another community that's just starting out. And so between Greta and John and what Helen and Mike have been doing for several years now, the OASIS community is growing and vibrant and is obviously meeting an important need in the secular community for weekly fellowship, development of resources for people who are going through either a transition from religion to a non-spiritual, non-religious belief, to simply people who have been secular all their lives and crave community just like everyone else. So I'm excited about this and really was happy to share these quick snippets with you from Helen and Greta, and wish them a lot of success. One more quick thing before we get to my conversation with Bart Ehrman. I wanted to inform you about the upcoming Recovering from Religion conference. This is not the organization that you may know about called Recovering from Religion, but a conference called Recovering from Religion, put on by an organization called MICA, which stands for Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And this is a conference that's being held from April 6 to 9 in Minneapolis. You can find more information about this conference and its schedule at micapraise.org. I'll also put the link in the show notes for this episode. My guest next week will be Marlene Winnell, who is the director of an organization called Journey Free. She's also the author of Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. She is a psychologist, a human development consultant, educator, and an expert in religious trauma syndrome. And we'll talk next week about all that stuff, but she's one of the speakers at this gathering called Recovering from Religion, Toxic Theology, PTSD, and the Road to Healing. So if you're in the Minnesota area, or if you can get up there on short notice, and you work in this area, I think it would be really beneficial. I personally wish I could make it. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make it. But the website says this conference is appropriate for healthcare professionals, clergy, and anyone whose life has been touched by a negative religious message, either personally or through the experience of a close relationship. Again, I'll put the link for this in the show notes. You can also find it at micapraise.org. And just click through a couple of links. It'll be obvious to you there. And I look forward to chatting with Marlene about this and much more next week. Now, without any further delay, here is my conversation with Bart Ehrman. Professor Bart Ehrman, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's such a great privilege to be talking to you. I've known about your work for quite a while, as I'm sure is not a surprise to you. A lot of people have benefited so much from the research and the writing that you've done. But the way I've known about your work is sort of the way one knows about other evil people without ever having read their work. You know, like I was
right.
I was warned about you in seminary, and I was told, you know, that people like you, critical scholars, were out to destroy the Christian faith and undermine the credibility of the Bible, and that we should not embrace what they called the historical critical method. And so I never read your work. I never read any of your writing up until the last couple of years, because I just thought you were up to no good. And so it was sort of suppressed. Your writing was sort of suppressed in my life. I was essentially, you know, like I said, warned off of you. And so is that what you've been up to all these years? Did you set out to undermine people's faith and your own faith?
Yeah. So now you've read my books and you know that they're right.
That's right. Exactly.
No, I've never seen what I'm doing that way at all. I really don't think that I'm trying to undermine Christianity or faith. I'm not a Christian myself, but when I started working in this field and started approaching the Bible from a historical perspective, I was a Christian, and the kind of Christianity I held wasn't damaged by this kind of historical critical research. My view was that if we have a better historical understanding of the Bible, that should be a good thing.
Right.
It shouldn't be a bad thing. And so I don't really see myself as trying to destroy the faith. I guess, you know, a lot of my books would be destroying a kind of fundamentalist faith.
Right.
So if somebody who has a very literalistic belief that the Bible has to have no mistakes of any kind whatsoever, someone like that would be threatened by my work. But I think, you know, most Christians in the world don't have that view.
So you said that you started off your career as a Christian and that you don't consider yourself a Christian now. Is that partly a result, obviously? I mean, it seems like it would be a result of your work, in part at least. I mean, what's your personal faith journey been like? I mean, one of the things we do on this podcast is talk to people about how their journey has evolved over time.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I'll sum up these 40 years in a couple sentences.
Awesome. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
So when I was in high school, I was raised in the Christian church. I was raised Episcopalian, and I was a very devout kid. When I was in high school, I had a born again experience and became a conservative evangelical Christian. And after high school, I went off to a fundamentalist Bible college, Moody Bible Institute, to study Bible and theology. When I graduated from there, and I was convinced the Bible was the inerrant revelation from God with no mistakes of any kind.
Right.
I went from there to Wheaton College to finish my bachelor's degree and took Greek there at Wheaton as my foreign language requirement because I wanted to read the New Testament in the original Greek. And that started a process for me. After Wheaton, I went to Princeton Theological Seminary because I wanted to study with the world's expert in Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, a man named Bruce Metzger. Mm-hmm. And while I was at Princeton, I started changing my views about the Bible because as I read the New Testament in Greek and I read the Old Testament in Hebrew, I started realizing, you know, in fact, there are mistakes here. There are discrepancies and contradictions and historical errors. And once I admitted that that was the case, then I started seeing more and more of them. I left the evangelical fold and became a fairly liberal Christian, and I was a good solid liberal Christian for many years. Even after getting my PhD, after teaching at Rutgers and starting to teach here at Chapel Hill, I was still a Christian. Even though I realized that the Bible had lots of problems with it. But it really was something else that changed my mind. The reason I left Christianity wasn't because of my biblical scholarship. It was because of my wrestling with the problem of suffering and trying to understand how there can be so much pain and misery in the world if there's a God who's in control of it. I just got to a point where I simply didn't believe it anymore. And I don't know, 18, 19, 20 years ago, I just decided that I was an agnostic. And so that's what I still am.
So how do you differentiate then? I mean, I think that's so, first of all, that's so many people's experience. It's partly what helped me move along in my own spiritual and intellectual journey. And so many people that I talk to on an almost daily basis just had this essential sort of, when you boil it all down, they would say it just didn't make sense to them. They couldn't, I mean, certain, it's almost like there are these five or six variables and you can get four of them to work, but the fifth one doesn't work. But then if you account for the fifth one, you know, one and two don't work or something. It's like you can't get all of them to line up. You know, God could be all powerful, but then not good, you know, if he's allowing, you know, so you have all these variables that you just can't get to line up. How do you then, you say you're an agnostic. What does that mean to you? Like, how do you understand your agnosticism?
Yeah, I actually describe myself in lots of ways. I consider myself an agnostic and an atheist and a humanist and all sorts of things. But I think people usually want to know why I say agnostic instead of atheist. And I'm actually both. What I used to think was that agnosticism and atheism were two different degrees of the same thing.
Right.
That agnostics are just people who aren't willing to say they were atheists, you know, or atheists were arrogant agnostics.
Right, right.
And I don't think that anymore. What I think now is that the term agnosticism has to do with what you claim to know. Agnosticism comes from a Greek word which literally means don't know. And so if somebody were to ask me, do you know if there's a superior divine being in the universe, I'd say, no, I don't know.
Right.
How the hell would I know?
Right, exactly. I don't have any special knowledge.
So
yeah.
I'm an agnostic on that level. I think atheism isn't about what you think you know. It's about what you believe.
Right.
So do I believe that there's a greater power in the universe? No, I don't believe it. But that's, you know, that's my faith, my yeah. belief. So I consider myself both to be an agnostic and to be an atheist at the same time.
Yeah, I think that really actually summarizes quite well how I view myself as well. And most of the people that I interact with who are, you know, free thinkers, thoughtful, you know, academics, or just armchair, you know, wannabe academics like me. I think, you know, we would say, yeah, there's a limit to what we can know, and we would describe ourselves using both words. And in spite of you know that agnostic atheism that you hold, you still find the Bible worth studying, obviously, because you continue to do it. And I want to come back to that a little bit later in our conversation, because at the end of your new book, Jesus Before the Gospels, you talk about the value of the stories in the Bible, whether or not they are historically accurate in terms of the details and factuality. But before we get to that, let's talk at least a little bit about the book itself. It is, as I said, called Jesus Before the Gospels, How the Earliest Christians Remembered, Changed, and Invented Their Stories of the Savior. It just came out from Harper One. And so the thesis of the book, as I understand it, is that memories are essential to understanding memory, and the way it works is essential to understanding how the Bible is passed down to us today, and that even in our own personal experiences, we can recognize the way that we misremember things, and the way that even if we just play a simple game of telephone, that basic, banal information is sort of miscommunicated quite easily. Is that influences the way the Bible is written? Isn't that right?
Yeah, so that's right. That's the idea. So the issue that I'm dealing with in the book is that almost everybody agrees that Jesus died around the year 30 of the Common Era, and that the first gospel to be written was the Gospel of Mark, which is usually dated around the year 70 of the Common Era. Mm-hmm. John is usually thought to be the last gospel written, maybe around 90 or 95 of the Common Era. But what that means is that there was a time gap of between 40 and 65 years before anybody wrote down accounts of Jesus' life that we have.
Right.
And so my question is, what's going on as people are telling and retelling the stories about Jesus over all those years? And that's where memory comes in, because people, obviously eyewitnesses, would have to remember what they heard and saw, but then the Gospels aren't being written by the eyewitnesses. They're written by people who'd known somebody, who heard something from someone else, who said that Jesus allegedly said this because of what they heard from a neighbor's wife. I mean, it's like, you know, you have these lines of transmission. And at every point, when somebody tells a story about what Jesus said or did, the next person has to remember it and then tell it to the next person, tell it to the next person. And this goes on for 4 or 6 decades.
It's amazing, because I never thought of this. growing up in the church, as I said, I think before we started recording, I mentioned to you I was a Seventh-day Adventist, and for 19 years I was a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. During that time, I became more liberal. I started reading more liberal scholarship. For me, liberal scholarship was like N.T. Wright and Walter Brueggemann. You know, that was for me like really stretching out of the theistic framework and really looking at what scholars were saying. And I had my, you know, some of my colleagues who would say, oh, N.T. Wright, you know, that's really going over off the deep end. And which is why I never read your books. I never even got that far.
So it never
dawned on me that, you know, this question of transmission. And I think the reason, as I've been reading your book the last week or two, the thing that comes to my mind as the only explanation I can give for why is that I was taught that the Holy Spirit superintended this process and made sure that the words were passed on in the right way. And Adventists don't have a literal verbal sense of inspiration. They have a thought inspiration approach, but they still would say that it was a reliable account of everything that's recorded. And it was just sort of by magic, I guess, that these accounts were kept pure. And I guess your arguments would be sort of impervious to that kind of a belief system in a way. Do you find that to be true, or do your arguments get through to people?
Right. I mean, the problem is, yeah, if you ascribe it all to a miracle, it's a little bit hard to think that evidence matters, because evidence doesn't matter anymore if it's a pure miracle.
Right.
So I, you know, my sense is that there are a lot of people like you who start off thinking that the Bible is completely inspired by the Spirit, but for one reason or another, they start reading people who have a slightly different point of view, and they start opening up to other ways of looking at things, and eventually they get around to thinking, you know, evidence matters.
Right.
And if you've got stories in the Gospels that flat out contradict each other, then they both can't be historically right. You know, you might think that they're containing theological truth, or they're important in for religious devotional reasons, but you wouldn't think that they can historically both be right. And I think that's a major step towards understanding what the Bible really is. It's a very human book written by humans who are at the tail end of a long period of oral transmission in which just regular old people are telling stories about Jesus until somebody bothers to write them down.
You know, just listening to you say that, I recall my last year in Bible college, I read a book written by an Adventist scholar called Inspiration, and then there was a subtitle that I don't remember, and he basically was talking about the Bible as a case book rather than a code book, basically that the Bible was recording cases from which we could deduce principles and spiritual insights, but not codes to be followed forever and ever throughout history and that type of thing. And that I think that might have been the beginning of me starting to wonder, wow, did Satan inspire David to take a census, or did God inspire David to take a census? It can't be both, right? The thing that occurs to me also reading your book, I think when I was a conservative Christian, I was concerned that there were so many discrepancies between things, as you say. But now that I'm not a Christian and I'm looking back and I'm reading your book this last week, and I'm actually now in the almost in the reverse position, sort of surprised that there's as much coherence as there is in the Gospels. You know, isn't that funny? Like, I think I started off thinking, wow, these things don't line up the way they ought to. And now I'm sort of surprised they line up as well as they do.
Yeah. Well, there are good reasons for that, for them lining up. I mean, so scholars since the 19th century have recognized that Matthew, Mark, and Luke basically tell the same story in the broad outline, the very basic same story, because Matthew and Luke got their stories from Mark, that they had copied Mark's, they'd copied most of Mark's stories, and then they added material to Mark. But as a result of that, they cohere in broad outline pretty well. But it's, you know, it's not because of the inspiration of the Spirit. And if you think about it for a second, that kind of makes sense, because you know, suppose the Gospel of John is right, that Jesus' ministry lasted up to maybe 3 years. If you read the Gospel of Mark out loud, it takes about 2 hours. Hmm. So you basically have 2 hours of material for a 3-year ministry. Now, suppose Matthew and Luke are a little bit longer, so say they take 3 hours. What's the chances that these three books are all going to give almost exactly the same stories.
Right.
You know, like if you've got 3 years to play, you've got somebody's life for 3 years, and you have three people writing about that life that went on for 3 years, what are the chances they're all going to pick the same stories?
Yeah, pretty unlikely.
Out of those 3 years. So that's one reason for being pretty sure that one of them was the source for the others. But if that's the case, then it's not surprising that they have so many similarities.
Well, and the similarities begin when the first record is written down, but who knows what kind of changes happened up until that point.
Well, that's right. And so that's my point, is that if you had independent people who had no influence from one another at all, but were just independent people recording what they had heard Jesus say and do, you'd have four radically different views rather than, you know, four that basically in the gist, at least, agree with each other.
So there's all this oral tradition out there, widely disparate notions, and then there's this bottleneck, it seems like, where one sort of authorized account is written down, or at least there are several authorized accounts, but through church politics and church history, one becomes the authorized tradition, and then it grows from there. So it's almost like there's a condensing of the sort of received wisdom about Jesus, and then it gets codified in writing, and then there's sort of this kind of uniformity a little bit, at least, across the Gospels.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is how it happened, that one version kind of emerges. And it's obviously not just one version. I mean, what I try to teach my students is to read each of the four accounts in the New Testament as its own literary product. You know, you read Mark for what Mark has to say, and you don't pretend it's saying the same thing John is saying, because in fact, their perspectives are very different in a lot of ways. But the basic gist of the story is very similar and becomes the story because of the success that these particular books enjoyed in the Christian churches.
One of my favorite parts of reading your books is hearing the stories that I didn't read growing up, stories of gospels that didn't make it into the canon or other extra biblical writings from the time period. And it's funny the way my mind works. And I suppose this is true for everyone. You know, when you read about this gigantically tall Jesus coming from the tomb, followed by a talking cross, the first thing that crosses my mind is, well, that's just absurd. But I accepted a resurrected Jesus without a blink of an eye, you know, like that didn't strike me as absurd at all. And it's just interesting the way that works, that this authorization of a particular tradition over time creates a sense of credibility that the other stories don't have.
No, that's right. You read a miracle in one of the Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, and you just roll your eyes and think, well, that's absurd.
Right.
But then you read about Jesus walking on the water, and, you know, well, yeah, that's something that probably happened.
Right, exactly. I'm sure that happened.
Outsiders would think that they're both, you know, they both seem equally odd.
Yeah. Well, you know, and one of the things, you know, now that I'm sort of on the other side of faith and part of a diverse and growing and evolving community of atheists and skeptics and humanists. There is, as you know, you are well aware, a sort of an academic and a very popular movement to say that Jesus never really existed, or at least that Jesus was a composite person that evolved over time. Does your research into memory and the way these traditions are passed down, has that influenced your view at all about, who Jesus was? Was there a singular Jesus as we have in the Gospels? Or is Jesus more of a pastiche kind of character that was pasted together over all these memories? I mean, how can you know? And what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, your mythicist listeners aren't going to like what I have to say about that.
Yeah, I know.
You may know I wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? Where
right.
I tried to show that the mythicist view is not credible. I don't think there's really any serious doubt that there was a man, Jesus of Nazareth, and that we can say some things about him. Certainly, he didn't do all the things that he's ascribed to doing in the Gospels, I think. But he did exist, and we do know some things. And I think that actually the mythicists are doing a disservice to the atheist community, because most people from the outside, instead of finding this to be an interesting and attractive proposition, think that it's just downright silly, and it just makes atheists look like idiots to most of the world. But whether they look like idiots or not, I think they just, you know, I think they're wrong on this point. There was a Jesus. We can say some things about him. And the thing that memory research has taught us is that even though when we remember things, we very often get details wrong, we're far more likely to get the gist of a memory right. And so the gist memories of Jesus that you can isolate in the Gospels, you know, many of them they're right. It doesn't mean that the Gospels are the inspired Word of God. It just means that you treat them like you would treat other historical sources, recognizing that they're at the end of a long period of oral transmission. But there's enough independent lines of tradition pointing to the same phenomenon to make you think there really was this man, and this is some of the things you can say about him.
Would you say it's correct, and this is again my non-expert sort of sense of it, that it really comes down to what you consider a source? It feels like a lot of the mythicists would say that the Bible doesn't count as a historical source because it's faith-based and people rely on it for their religious faith, so they would turn to other contemporaries of the time period to look for evidence that Jesus existed, and when they find very little or none, they conclude, or I mean, again, I'm waving over, you know, mountains and mountains of, you know, research here with one sweep of my hand, but it feels like in some sense it comes down to what do you consider to be a source. And you're saying, if I understand you correctly, that the Bible, even though it's a collection of memories orally transmitted and then copied over centuries, still is a kind of source.
Yeah, I think that that's an untenable position to say that since people believe in the Bible, it can't be seen as a historical source. I mean, the fact that people in the 21st century have views of the Bible that we don't accept, that has no bearing on what the Bible actually was when it was written. Whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew was not planning on writing the Bible. He didn't think that he was writing scripture. He didn't think he was inspired by God. He was simply writing down the stories of Jesus that he had heard that he wanted to record for posterity. And that's why he's a source, just like every source in the ancient world is a source. Nobody would reject a description of the imperial cult. A description of what happens, say, when you sacrifice to an emperor or when you sacrifice to another god. Nobody would reject that as a source simply because it's written by somebody who happened to believe that you should sacrifice to the emperor or to another god. These are accepted as historical sources because they are historical sources. And so classicists and ancient historians simply don't have this view that you can't accept the Gospels because today a lot of people believe in them. I mean, that's a rather silly point of view.
Right. Yeah. And I think there might be some motivations. You know, I don't know what, you know, the author of the Gospel of Matthew's motivation was in writing it down. It might have been purely academic or interesting information, but whether he had a faith motivation in writing it down to pass on the tradition, but nevertheless,
he certainly had a faith motivation. But the idea that you can only use sources that are written by people who have no motivation means you cannot write history of any kind.
Right.
I mean, that's like saying that you can't appeal to eyewitness testimonies of the Holocaust because these people were interested in what they were describing.
Right.
Well, of course you can use them.
Right.
And of course you have to take into account what their perspectives and biases are.
Right.
But you do that with every source. It's not like, you know, there's one set of sources that are objective, and you've got this tiny little sliver of things that are not objective, namely the Christian sources about Jesus. And since those are not objective, we're not going to use them. We're just going to use the objective sources. I mean, even when Tacitus describes the Christians persecuted by the Emperor Nero, he's got a prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that you throw it out and say, well, no, he had a prejudice, so we're not going to use it? Of course not. Historians certainly use Tacitus to understand what happened in the reign of Nero. But you take his prejudice into account. When you study Matthew's gospel, if you want to know what historical realities lie behind the gospel, you take his prejudices into account. You don't simply get rid of his book.
Right. Yeah, I know. I think that's really... really makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, we all struggle to get around our biases, and that's why we need, you know, peers to review what we're doing and, you know, comparative research and all of the rest. And I really appreciate what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, coming from my background, I've sort of left biblical reading and all of that behind for the last couple of years just to get a little distance from it. And it's interesting now coming back to it, how different it all looks. And yet I'm still drawn to the stories. I still find,
yes,
for example, the sayings ascribed to Jesus, like, you know, love your enemies and do good to those who curse you. You know, these things are still inspiring and motivational to me, whether or not they were in Jesus' mouth or not. So you still have this really, yes, compelling story of people who are trying to figure out the world and their place in it.
Yeah, my sense is that, you know, when it comes to something like the Gospels or the sayings of Jesus in the Gospels, that there, for me at least, there are two kinds of questions. One question is, you know, as a historian, I'm interested, you know, did Jesus really say this? Did Jesus really do this? What really happened historically? I have that set of questions. But the other set of questions is the one that you're referring to, which is, you know, is this interesting to me or not? Just on the kind of a personal level, is this the sort of thing that I find attractive, or do I find it repugnant, or something else?
Right.
And I think both kinds of questions are important to bring to the gospel, not just to the gospels, but to any kind of literature, really,
right,
any kind of historical literature. But again, that's because I don't separate the gospels off from other kinds of religious literature.
So the Bible in today's modern American, let's just limit it to America for the moment, in our world in the United States, and probably elsewhere too, but maybe more so here in the United States, the Bible is used in some very damaging ways to impose political will on the public, to say, to legislate against, or to attempt to legislate against, for example, gays and lesbians and so forth. And so a lot of people have really distanced themselves from the Bible as really the core problem, whether or not people believe in God or not. A more fundamental question is, how do they take the Bible? And so I wanted to ask you, what value do you see? Do you see any value in the Bible for sort of modern people, or how do we treat it in today's world? What would you be, yeah, your advice, yeah, for people?
Well, you know, I think the Bible is a complex book because it's written by dozens of different authors living in different periods of time, living in different countries, writing to different audiences. They have different views. They have different perspectives. They have different beliefs. So the Bible, you know, I don't think is one thing. I think it's lots of things. And so my view of the Bible is that you can't take it as some kind of authority for for like modern ethical issues, because the Bible has all sorts of ethical issues depending on what part of it you're reading. And so everybody, whether they admit this or not, everybody who wants to appeal to the Bible for something is picking and choosing what they want to appeal to.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
And so fundamentalists today are quite happy to say that, you know, women cannot exercise any authority over a man because of a passage found in 1 Timothy, because, hey, it's in the Bible.
Right.
But these same people have no trouble at all with, for example, wearing clothing that has mixed fabric in it. Well, the Bible condemns that too. The Bible says if you're supposed to, you know, that if you disobey your parents, you're supposed to be stoned to death. And so the people who want to disallow women from having any function in society, do they think they should be stoning their children to death whenever they disobey? Of course not. They're picking and choosing what they think is appropriate. So since everybody does that, I think the key to reading the Bible is to figure out what you want to pick and choose. And if I think the Bible contains enormously important teachings that can still be of huge value for us. So, I mean, when Jesus teaches that you should love your neighbor as yourself, I think that's a good teaching.
Right.
Or that you should do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. I think that's right. That is how you ought to live. And so it's not that the Bible is this inspired authority telling us detail by detail. It's that the Bible contains passages and entire books that are fantastic, and we ought to appreciate it for that.
And wouldn't you also agree that the ethical teachings of the Bible are in some ways a reflection of sort of common, to borrow our expression, a kind of humanist ethical impulse that transcends religions and cultures too? You know, the idea that we should, do unto others as we would have them do unto us, that we would, you know, avoid doing to someone what we would not like to be done to us, is something that is not given to us from the Bible, but is reflected in the Bible the same way it's reflected in other cultures as well.
Yes. And the answer to that is yes. I think that, in fact, there are ethical teachings in the Bible that everybody on the planet would be better off following. There are other ethical teachings that would be a disaster if everybody followed. And the question is how you choose what is what. And I think you have to have some criteria. For me, the criteria are all humanist.
Right.
What promotes the greatest good among humans on earth? I don't think that oppression of women does. I don't think slavery does. I don't think stoning your children to death when they disobey you does. I mean, but there are other things that absolutely do promote the greatest welfare for the greatest number of humans. And I think that those should be the kinds of things that we pay attention to.
How do you feel about Americans' capacity to treat the Bible in this non-literal way? My sense is that we're not very close to that point, and that your work in sort of de-weaponizing the Bible by showing that it's not what we've been taught that it is helps in that venture. But do you think it anytime soon it would be good to recommend the Bible to people? I mean, sometimes I feel like I almost don't want to recommend the Bible to people. I mean, I don't anymore, except with these caveats that, like, don't read it the way your Sunday school teacher taught you about it. Read it the way you would read any sort of ancient history or ancient narrative.
Well, right. I mean, I think the problem is the problem really is American fundamentalism, which is both a recent and a regional development. Most Christians throughout the history of the world have not treated the Bible as this kind of dictatorial, you have to do this and that kind of book. Most people, of course, throughout history haven't bothered to read the Bible very much. Their faith is rooted in the traditions that are handed down to them by the church. And,
right.
Protestant fundamentalists, of course, think that everything has to be based on the Bible, even though they themselves don't follow the Bible.
Right.
My view of the whole thing is the Bible is one of the great books of the history of Western civilization. I think without a doubt, the most important book in the history of Western civilization. Mm. And that's for a reason. It's because it contains great material, and people should get to know it better and should attend to its basic teachings. Its basic teachings are not that you ought to enslave people and stone your children and oppress your women. It's the basic teachings, I think, are something much broader and more helpful than that, about living for other people and being concerned about the welfare of those who are in need.
Yeah. And I think as I progressed in my theology, my theological development towards a more liberal point of view, that's what my picking and choosing changed to a more liberal version of that. And you so beautifully point out in the introduction to the book too, how there are all these different, the difference between Bill O'Reilly's God and and Reza Aslan, I mean, Jesus, like Bill O'Reilly's Jesus and Reza Aslan's Jesus, you know, couldn't be more different, you know, like, for Bill O'Reilly, yeah. Jesus is protesting taxation. And that's when he really despises, you know, the government overreach. And, for Reza, it's, a zealot, attempting to change the government, overthrow the Romans.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's how I start out, because I want to emphasize that people's memory of Jesus today is radically different depending whom you talk with. And for me, that's an introduction to the question of whether that's always been true. The answer, I think, is yes.
Right.
Was it true back in the first century? I think the answer is yes. Was it true for the different gospel writers? Yes. They each remember Jesus differently. But more important for this book is the people who were telling the stories before the gospel writers were remembering Jesus differently. And it's the way they told their stories that affected the gospel that have come down to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember first reading John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus, and I thought, man, I'd never met this Jesus before. My growing up experience in the church did not introduce me to that community organizing Jesus, you know, who was deliberately rebelling, yes, in a way that was designed to cause, change, but also a pacifist at the same time. It's a very carefully constructed Jesus. And, I see, evangelicals doing that. In fact, I just had a conversation via Facebook today with someone who was arguing that it wasn't that significant that the Bible endorses and even sometimes encourages slavery, because the overall teaching of the Bible was that we should love our neighbors. And I said back to him, like, yes, I agree the overall teaching of the Bible is to love our neighbors, but it still also says to enslave people, or doesn't explicitly condemn slavery. And it was so hard for him. In fact, he wasn't able to account for that, and or to at least admit it. I wasn't actually saying that if the Bible commands slavery, the whole thing is useless. I was just saying it relativizes its value in my mind if I recognize that there are these ethical problems. Once I begin to see, yeah, that the armor is not one whole piece that is impenetrable, then I can say, oh, it's a human document written by humans who are grappling with ethical issues at their time, and it doesn't necessarily apply to me in every case, and I have to do actual work to distill from it. And furthermore, the Bible isn't the only document that we should be looking to. I've been reading Marcus Aurelius lately and trying to understand what he has to offer. And if you take Marcus Aurelius literally and apply everything he has to say, you'd be a pretty bad person, I think, in a modern society. But we don't do that with Marcus Aurelius. Nobody's ever taught us to do that with Marcus Aurelius. We take Marcus Aurelius to be just a guy who had some wise things to say. And I don't know, yeah, if we'll ever get there with the Bible. That's, I guess, my concern.
Well, we might get there. I think apart from American fundamentalism, a lot of the world's there already. It's just, we live in a context where it seems like our little slice of the world is the whole world, and it's really not.
Good point.
And it hasn't been the way the Bible has been. So I think that, I haven't abandoned hope yet.
Well, and I think it's, and if we do get there, I would hasten to say it's because of people like you who are just constantly not just writing for the Academy in articles and papers that will only be read by your peers, but also for the rest of us who grew up with a different view of the Bible. And you point out, back to the idea of memory, that if an authoritarian person or an authority in your life tells you to believe something, that you will actually believe something that you didn't actually experience, or you'll remember that you experienced something that you didn't really experience, because this authority has so much influence in our lives. And I think I can think of numerous examples after reading your book where I thought, I think this was an answer to prayer because I believe that it was, and other people told me that it was, and I thought something really special happened. And now I really think that it was just a special but ordinary sort of, yeah, experience. And so I think for people like you who do have a long career of researching all of these things in a way that the rest of us will never have time or capacity to do, really does help us get to a place where we can look at the Bible differently. We don't have to just say it's like, an evil book through and through, but we can have a realistic relationship with it.
Yes, yes. Well, that's my hope.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I want to come back to a personal note, because you talked in brief terms about your journey. And for a lot of our listeners, this journey is going on for them right now. They're discovering the things you write about in this book sort of as we speak. And they're thinking, oh, crap, I thought this story was airtight and I'm realizing now that it's not. And one of the ways that it impacts people, certainly it impacted me, is in the way that my relationships with others in my life have changed now that I don't have the same worldview or belief system. And I'm wondering, as you went through both a personal and an academic transition in your beliefs, how did that transition in your life affect your relationships with your family, your friends, your colleagues? Did you lose friends? Did your family get mad at you and write you off? And you've had some time to process through that. Have they come back to you, some of those relationships?
Yeah, so no, I think it's the hardest thing with having a complete change in religious point of view is that a lot of your family and your friends are themselves wrapped up in the worldview that you're leaving and that you're finding problematic. It was hard in my case because I was doing this from an academic point of view, and so I was rigorously studying this material. And so when I would get in a disagreement with somebody, with a friend or a family member, it really wasn't a fair fight because I had, you know, this is what I was spending every day, all day long working on.
Right.
And so it led to some animosity and some disagreeable situations, especially with family members. I think, I guess I lost friends, but I didn't really lose them. It's like, the kind of people that I wanted to associate with before were not the kind of people that really were appealing to me anymore. And vice versa, you know, they just, we didn't have the same kind of common ways of looking at the world anymore.
Right.
And their assumptions about the world are very different from mine. When it comes to family members, my view is that there are a lot of things that are much more important than your particular religious beliefs or your theological views. And so my mother, for example, she's a good Christian woman who's continues to be a conservative evangelical Christian, and we basically don't talk about religion.
Right.
even though religion is very important to her personally, and even though it's obviously, you know, my entire life of research, we just don't go there. We talk about basketball and
right.
family and the past. And, you know, so I think that if people have a genuine love for each other, that love can overcome the kind of conflict that would arise because of a changed religious point of view. And so the thing to do is to focus on the things that you continue to agree on rather than, trying to convert one another to whatever your new point of view is.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And sometimes those initial walls that go up come down rather quickly. I mean, I know that in my case, some family members were rather shocked that I was, from their perspective, I was one day a pastor and the next day an atheist. Of course, it didn't happen like that in my actual experience. But
yeah.
from their perspective, it was this really shocking, sudden shift. And, you know, but I had been pondering these things privately for a very long time. And I think they were scared
right.
of me. They didn't know because I had spent my life, you know, studying theology, and I have, you know, a terminal degree in theology and as well. And I've, you know, done a lot of this work, and I've been a pastor for so many years. I don't think they were eager for a fight. On the other hand, they didn't want me to go around undermining their faith, of which, of course, I was not interested in doing. Well, what are you working on next? What's next for you? What's on your mind?
So I'm hot right now on my next topic. So now that I've done sort of memory and the oral traditions of Jesus, I've moved on to something completely different, which is the question of how it is that Christianity went from being this tiny little group of the Jewish followers of Jesus to become the official religion of the Roman Empire. So in the Gospels, after Jesus' death, there's 11 of his disciples and a handful of women who believe he got raised from the dead. So say 20 people. These are lower class Aramaic-speaking peasants from Galilee.
Right.
How do you go from that to the time of the Emperor Constantine, 300 years later, when Constantine converts to Christianity, something like 5 or 6 million people in the Roman Empire are Christian? So how do you get from 20 to 6 million? And by the end of the fourth century, of course, it becomes the official Roman religion of the entire empire. And so then you've got 30 million Christians. And so I'm interested in what it is the Christians were doing to convert all these people. And, you know, when I was a evangelical Christian, I thought that the Holy Spirit was doing it.
Right.
But there seem to be flaws in that logic. And so I'm going to look at it from a very historical point of view.
That's amazing. I mean, just a few episodes ago, two episodes ago on this podcast, I spoke to Susan Jacoby, who just released her new book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. And I wonder if you've had a chance to read it or if you...
No, I haven't read it yet. No.
Yeah, so she's taking a much longer view in terms of conversions over a long sweep of history. It sounds like your focus is more, you know, the first couple of centuries. I think it's a fascinating question because I think a lot of Christian apologists turn to this issue as a kind of evidence that the gospels are true and that there's a God and the Spirit is working. Because, like you say, how could, if Jesus was only, a Galilean peasant who thought he was the Messiah but really wasn't, and they killed him like they killed so many others, what makes him so special that these followers would be willing to risk their lives in turn to tell his story?
Yeah.
And then others would be willing to be tortured and martyred to tell the story, on and on and on. So it is a very interesting question. I'm really eager to see what you find.
Well, I think if these apologists are right, it was all God's doing, they've got a lot of explaining to do, because there are 2 billion Christians in the world, but the vast majority of people are not Christians. So
right.
God hasn't been doing it anymore, I guess.
yeah. Or there's a serious communication gap, you know, like one of my atheist friends likes to say, you know, if God was really adept at communicating, like, as you mentioned a moment ago, how to construct the fabrics in a garment to avoid, you know, offending him, but seemed to be okay with rape and slavery. So there is definitely you know, if God has very particular outcomes in mind, he's having a hard time communicating them in a way that the rest of the world can grasp their import. So I'm really interested to see how this unfolds, because I think it's an important chapter that has been, at least in my upbringing, somewhat neglected. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I know you're busy with everything, including your teaching work as well as promoting your new book, but it's a service to all of us what you do, and it's a true honor for me to chat with you. So thank you so much for doing it, and best of luck with everything you're doing next.
Great. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That was a real treat for me, and I hope you will go check out his new book, Jesus Before the Gospels, How the Earliest Christians Remembered, Changed, and Invented Their Stories of the Savior. Bart Ehrman is as I said at the top of the show, a renowned scholar and well-respected in the biblical studies community. And I don't necessarily share his optimism for the American public to detach themselves from their view of the Bible and their use of the Bible in the public discourse. I have a slightly more pessimistic view that the Bible will continue to dominate the political scene in a negative way. And I do believe that this idea that the Bible is historically factual and divinely inspired weaponizes the Bible and turns it into a tool of abuse and harm in society. And one of the best things that we can do is undermine those claims. And I think that's what Bart does in this book and in many of his other books, which many of you have looked at. And so I do appreciate everything he's doing to shed the light of reason and history and literary criticism to the Bible. And it helps us all. So, I mean, I think we need to get this message out to people that won't be inclined to read it and understand what Bart is saying, but it's a good start for those of us who are inclined to agree with Bart to internalize this information, so that when we come into contact with people who make rather dubious claims about the Bible, that we're prepared to share with them some of the problems. So anyway, that was exciting for me, and I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks so much again for tuning in. Please subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast. You can also go to Spreaker. We're at spreaker.com/lifeaftergod. When you do that, you will get a notification every time we upload some new material or go live when we are doing a live show. So follow us on Spreaker and follow us on social media. You can go to our website at lifeaftergod.org, and all the links to our social media accounts are there. There's a lot of good stuff happening on our Facebook page at facebook.com/ourlifeaftergod. Brian Peck, part of our team here, makes amazing memes and things that you can share on your wall to draw more attention to what life after God means, both in your life and in the lives of so many others that are going through this same experience. I hope you'll tune in next week. My guest next week will be Marlene Winnell, the director of Journey Free. She works with groups and individuals who are recovering from the psychological effects of toxic religion in their lives. And I'm going to talk to her about what it takes for people to recover from religion when they've been deeply abused by it. Looking forward to talking to her. And also, if you are in the Minneapolis area or are in this line of work and are a psychologist or social worker looking to work with people that are struggling with the after effects of toxic religion, I hope you'll check out the conference that I mentioned a moment ago and check out the link in the show notes for more information about the Recovering from Religion conference that she's a part of. Thanks again for tuning in and spending this time with me. My name is Ryan Bell, and this has been Life After God.